Interfaith Alliance. This is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you've made a donation this week, I want to say thank you sincerely. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
2 years after the Women's March movement sparked the largest single-day protest in U.S. history, and a record number of women were just elected into office, controversy may be dismantling the group.
With winter in full swing, it's time for us to head out onto some thin ice. After massive turnouts for women's marches nationwide in January 2016 and 2017, the inexperienced and likely at times overwhelmed activists at the center of the movement have faced harsh criticism, accusations of bigotry, and even competing marches in the coming weeks. Now, none of this advances the core agenda of resistance and demands for respect that draws so many first-time marchers to the cold January streets in the past 2 years. Is there a way for a movement this large to heal and mature while not losing its momentum? Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times writer Farah Stockman has analyzed this question in depth, and she'll be with us on this week's State of Belief Radio.
People are not abandoning Christianity, but they're going back to something, or they're discovering something that might be new to them, of really supporting separation between church and state because they believe that it damages the religion. And I think that we can see quite a bit of evidence of that when you merge the two.
Ex-evangelical. It's a tough word to say, and an even tougher thing to become. But even as the political religious right is stronger and more pernicious today than it first was a generation ago, so too is it more pressing for many who find themselves defined by an identity that no longer makes neither moral nor personal sense to flee. Dr. Christopher Stroup is a leader in this movement, founder of the hashtag Empty the Pews initiative, and I'm really looking forward to having him back to talk with him later in the hour. But first,
this is a choice between right and wrong, justice and injustice. This is about whether we fulfill our sacred duty to the American citizens we serve.
School integration, the Cuban Missile Crisis, the attacks of 9/11. For as long as there's been TV, U.S. presidents have reserved the format of an Oval Office address to the nation for messages of unity, encouragement, and inspiration. My, how things have changed. This week, the disruptor-in-chief upended that sober tradition with an 8-minute presentation that underscored how devoid of empathy and American values our public rhetoric has devolved to. Voices of faith have long challenged this nationalist, fear-based narrative, and few have been as articulate as that of Bishop Minerva Carcano, who serves as the head of the United Methodist Church's Immigration Task Force. And as national attention is refocused on border issues, I am really grateful to welcome her back to State of Belief Radio. Bishop Carcano, thanks for being with us again.
Thank you. It's a joy to be with you.
What did you find yourself thinking as you listened to extremist propaganda being mainstreamed by a nationalist leader this week?
I felt that we were being led by lies, that we were being pushed into more racism and hate mongering, that we were being asked to stand against children who are suffering at many levels, certainly the migrant children at the border and in detention, the migrant children of those federal workers who are under the government shutdown, the children who are dependent on public service, who are also caught up in this web, tremendous web of lies. We are being led to believe that there's a emergency at the border that requires militarization and that is so deep and so awful, terrible, that we've got to shut down the government. There is no such emergency. Mm-hmm. What we have is a humanitarian crisis at the border, a small one at that, that this country can address and can address from a historic, compassionate heart that believes in caring for the poorest among us, that has policies for asylum seekers to seek a way out of the violence and even poverty that they face.
What kind of impact does this kind of fear-mongering have on some of the most vulnerable communities in our nation?
Well, we've got a whole stretch of border communities that are being divided. They are communities from Brownsville, Texas, to San Diego, California, that have long, for many generations, lived together with their counterparts on the other side of the border, who have together welcomed new people, migrants and immigrants. Those communities are being held hostage. They're being held under growing militarization. Their land is being taken for a border wall that will not resolve the immigration situation, the migration that we are experiencing. It is not a good thing to do to those border communities. I also experience it affecting our congregations and our communities all across this country as I work in leading our church on the issue of immigration. We have communities that are polarized because they don't know what to believe. We have communities that are spewing out hatred against their immigrant neighbors, many of them who are documented immigrant neighbors. That's the kind of crisis that we're facing in this country, and it's being shaped by political agendas that do not have at heart the communities that this country should be paying attention to and serving.
Bishop Cocanyo, you've been at the border. Your ministry centers on these issues. I don't know of anyone else that I trust more to tell us the truth about what's happening there. So what is the truth about the people we see struggling to cross our borders, particularly when coming with their children?
Well, the children who are coming with their families, those who have come in the caravan that we experienced coming in the fall into the winter, even now, because some of them are still stuck at the border, are seeking asylum. They are seeking asylum because of the fear of violence and certainly because of the poverty that violence and other factors create. They have a right to seek asylum. We have asylum processes. But rather than responding by, for example, increasing the number of immigration officers who can address their claim for asylum, our government is sending more military forces to the border. Military forces who all they can do is be a backdrop for the Border Patrol men and women who are at the border. They don't have authority to do much more than that. We're propping up a scandalous situation that doesn't have to be a scandalous situation. If we would step up into this caravan's their struggle for justice and say, let us see your asylum claim. Here are additional judges and immigration people to assist you. If we would do that, if we would turn to communities like congregations of faith along the border who want to help and say, who can take a family in while we process them, there would be a positive response, because that's the heart of this country. That certainly is the heart of people on the border and many of us who support them. If we would begin to address the root causes of why they are coming, their countries bear a great responsibility for the struggles of those seeking asylum at the border, but we bear responsibility too. For generations, the United States has intervened in those countries, in El Salvador and Honduras and Guatemala, through regional economic agreements that have affected those regions, affected the people of those countries. We've even propped up corrupt governments in those countries in order to get our economic benefit from their natural resources. There comes a point when we have to address the ill that we have done, the bad that we have done, the evil that we have brought into communities. Something will happen. The caravan that we're seeing is what's happening because of all of our intervention in these countries and also the weakness and the corruption of their own governments. But this country is a government, historically, a government based on welcoming the poor, welcoming those who struggle. We are, I believe, a country of compassion. We've got to take a deep breath and work and speak from our heart rather than from this hyper-militarization of the southern border that's bred from these campaign slogans that were bad when they were first stated and are bad today.
You know, there is such a cavernous disconnect between what my faith tells me about being human and being moral and the forces that come to the fore. How can we, as religious leaders, how can we reclaim the language of faith for the fundamental messages of love one another and welcome the stranger?
I think we need to go back to our study of Scripture. I hear more false proclamation from too many of our pulpits than what is in Scripture. Now, what's in Scripture is not always easy. To love God, that might be something we can do perhaps superficially. But God says, if you really love me, then you've got to love your neighbor. You've even got to love your enemy. We've got to go back to that preaching that is scripturally based. And we've got to speak up in the world. There are too many who say, don't speak to me about the politics of the world and the church. We've got to remember that Jesus was a very political person, but his politics were grounded in the politics of the kingdom of God, not in the politics of the empire, not in the politics of human life, but the higher politics of God's love and justice. We've got to be willing to take the risk to proclaim that in the church and out in the world. We've got to be a moral voice. I hear too few moral voices from our religious communities. I don't do enough myself because I get caught up in the work of the bureaucracy of the church. But the church is not going to last if we don't take that position that Jesus himself calls us to be about, to be those disciples that go out and transform the world with the love of God and the justice of God's own kingdom.
Bishop Concarneau, with all due respect to the woman two heartbeats away from the presidency and to the minority leader of the U.S. Senate, the Democratic response to Tuesday's Oval Office address seemed to me more political than passionate. What would have been your response to what you heard the president say?
I believe it needed to be a response that called for compassion and for justice, that highlighted the children who have recently died. They are but two of hundreds of children who have died because of our broken immigration policies. It should have been a statement that moved away from political campaigning and party politics to doing the right thing. Mm. There have been those politicians who have said, I'm not going there because it will undermine my party. It may be time to consider what party life looks like, political party life looks like in this country, and begin to reframe it, reshape it, allow it to die in order to raise up the kind of politics that truly is about doing the best for the common good.
Boy, we need to have a long, long conversation about what you've just said, because I am so much in step with where you are, but that's what we can't do that today. Maybe another day soon. I do want to ask you before we get off, is there organizing that's taking place right now that gives you hope that we will see successful challenges to this administration's anti-immigrant policies?
Yes, I see the organizing happening through ACLU, through religious organizations, through other bodies, people just showing up at the border in order to join those who are welcoming the migrant, but those who are also strategizing around what is happening to impact government. I think the midterm elections that just happened are a result of the kind of broad-based organizing that is happening in this country, and that's going to continue to happen.
Bishop Minerva Carcano is bishop of the California-Nevada Annual Conference of the United Methodist Church and serves as the leader of the denomination's United Methodist Church's Immigration Task Force. I am so grateful that you will take time to be with us on State of Belief Radio. Thank you.
I want to thank you for all you do, and I'm always ready to come and be in dialogue with you, because we stand together, and it's going to take all of us standing together for what God expects of us. God bless.
There's lots more still to come on this week's show. Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times writer Farrah Stockman will be here to analyze where things stand with the upcoming 3rd National Women's March. And up next, ex-evangelical activist Dr. Christopher Stroup. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. Dr. Christopher Stroup is a writer and scholar of religion and politics and the U.S. Christian right. A founder of the hashtag Empty the Pews movement, his provocative article, Five Key Moments from the Year of the Ex-Evangelicals, appeared recently in Religion Dispatches. This seemed like a good time to invite him to be back with us, and so I'm pleased to once again welcome Dr. Stroup to State of Belief Radio. Chris, thanks for taking time to be with us again.
Thank you, Welton. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
Would you start with what you mean by the word ex-evangelical? Is it as simple as it sounds like it is?
I think it is more or less, but it does seem to be misunderstood a lot. So maybe it's not as simple as it seems to me, or at least it's a bit confusing to people. So it's simply a kind of contraction or abbreviation of the term ex-evangelical. And it's starting to become more popular, particularly on Twitter. So that's why I used it in this article that I wrote for the headline, Five Key Moments in the Year of the Exvangelicals, because we started to refer to something that could be considered to be an exvangelical community or a movement. And one of the key points about this movement, it relates to what we talked about last time I was on your show, and we were talking about how with the hashtag Empty the Pews, I mean to protest toxic Christianity, and I don't mean to be anti-religious. I mean to call people to follow their own consciences, whether that means that they remain within the Christian faith or they find some way forward in a kind of better, healthy, good Christianity or other religion, or they decide to be not religious. So for me, I'm an agnostic, and I can identify with the term exvangelical, but so can many progressive believers who grew up in the evangelical tradition. And now, after everything that's happened, Trump is kind of the culmination of roughly the last 40 years of transformations in evangelicalism that many people, many of us in the community who are, late Gen Xers or early millennials grew up, or even later millennials grew up with all of this culture warring and indoctrination. And so we've rejected the label. Whether we keep the label Christian or not is a choice that individuals make, and we try to build bridges between people who land on both sides of that divide. It can sometimes be contentious, but I think that's an important thing to understand about what the term exvangelical means to those of us who use it. You know, some are really convinced atheists and some are committed Christians, but we're really trying to bridge that gap because we come from the same background. We have a lot to talk about with each other because unpacking these experiences collectively helps us feel like we're not alone and it helps us to heal, but it also serves to expose evangelicalism for what it's become, for this toxic thing that it's become. And, we can really only do that collectively. There are a lot of great memoirs out there about abusive experiences of religion, but they can be written off as perhaps fringe or just individual experiences. But when you get thousands of people coming together and saying we experienced this, it's much harder to ignore.
Well, let's go over the five key moments that you focus on in your Religion Dispatches article. Go to it.
And a shout out to my editor, Evan Derkach, as well. So number five was just kind of silly, but it also, somebody in our community submitted our definition of Beverly as a slang term, taking the name Beverly to Urban Dictionary, and it was accepted. The idea is that in the exvangelical community, and we use it for both men and women, but it was inspired by a meme where, well, it was just a social media post. A woman whose name was Beverly posted about how her sister died in a fire, but wasn't it a miracle that her Bible was spared? And, a lot of people looked at that, and it went viral on social media, and people were thinking, somebody died, but you're happy that the Bible was safe? So someone in our Facebook group called Exvangelical suggested that when evangelicals say something that's sort of really problematic in this providentialist way, we would call them a Beverly.
Okay, number two.
So then I focused on our best exvangelical hashtags of 2018. There was a snarky one that a Twitter user came up with, an anonymous Twitter user, called hashtag how to evangelical. It's very millennial phrasing there. I kind of love it for that. And that got over 10,000 tweets in a day. We also had a situation where there was a man who previously attended Baptist Bible College in Pennsylvania. They renamed the college Clark Summit University at some point. He dropped out in 2003. His name is Gary Campbell. He joined the Navy, but then he was discharged fairly quickly over alcoholism and drunk driving. Well, he got his life back together. He wanted to complete his degree, and he wants to be a counselor now, helping people who have issues with substance abuse. And Gary is a gay man. So he applied to re-enroll in Clark Summit University. And initially he was accepted. And then a few weeks later, he got a phone call from the Dean of Men who said, "But we seem to have discovered that you're living a homosexual lifestyle, and that doesn't comport with our student code of conduct, so your acceptance is rescinded." And Gary only needed 6 credits to finish his degree. He wasn't even going to be on campus. He was going to finish it online. So once we learned about this situation in the evangelical community, we created the hashtag LetGaryGraduate to try to shine a media spotlight on this situation and put pressure on Clark Summit University. Clark Summit University never responded, but another college, Lackawanna College, there locally, stepped up, a little private school, and found a way to transfer most of his credits, which can be a problem because often from, you know, little Bible colleges, it's difficult to transfer the credits. And then the organization HeartStrong also stepped up, since this was going to be more expensive to finish his degree at Lackawanna College. It's HeartStrong is an organization that does outreach to LGBTQ people who end up being persecuted or harmed somehow in the environment of religious education, not just Christian colleges, but any religious college where this happens. They'll try to help people if they can. And they have a new fund that allowed them to give him a $3,000 scholarship disbursed directly to the school so Gary can finish his degree. So it was really nice to be a part of making that happen. I've had a few other hashtags that went viral again this year. Hashtag Christian Alt Facts, which looks at a lot of the kinds of, we'd call them alternative facts that, you know, we grew up with in Christian schools or homeschooling with the Becca and Bob Jones kind of curriculum, ranging from things like the Loch Ness Monster was real and proves that evolution is false to to things like, well, apartheid was good for South Africa because the black Africans would never have built up such a nice country themselves. Those kinds of things are, you know, in that curriculum. So in order to expose that, we use the hashtag Christian Alt Facts.
Well, let's go to three if we can now.
Sure. So in my countdown, at number three, I put our offline events that we had this year, where we really kind of drew attention to them as a community and invited people to come and meet locally, hoping to build synergy to create local connections, which then might bring more people into the online community, which in turn blows up and can bring more people into offline communities. And I think a lot of us really just miss probably having something like a church community that feels intimate like that. And it's difficult in modern American society to make social connections sometimes outside of a religious environment. So we wanted to start having these public conversations, not just online, but offline as well. And a number of us were able to put together a panel discussion, crowdfund it using GoFundMe, and put it on in Clearwater, Florida on last September 8th. And it was called the Exvangelical Community Paths, Projects, Prospects. And it was a pretty good cross-section of people. And we also had the historian of religion and religious studies scholar, Julie Ingersoll from North Florida University, as a discussant who could bring a lot of context to this. And it was hosted by Blake Chastain of Exvangelical Pod, or his podcast, Exvangelical Podcasts. And it was also recorded so that it can be people can go find that episode of the podcast and they can hear the discussion if they weren't present there in Florida in September. So we had Catherine Brightbill, who works for the Coalition for Responsible Home Education, doing very important work on advocating for, you know, some level of reasonable regulation for homeschooling so that it's not used in abusive ways, as it too often is. And a lot of people in the evangelical community have had issues with going through, you know, kind of radical indoctrinating homeschooling, and in some cases also suffered a lot of physical and or sexual abuse that wasn't seen because they were homeschooled. I would just also highlight Akiko Ross, who talked about, and she's older than a lot of us. I think she's she's a boomer, and she talks about years of experience working in Southern Baptist churches as a women's leader and Sunday school teacher, and how Trump was the last straw for her, and particularly as a woman of color. So that was interesting. And we did another event in Chicago in October. It was partly a book launch event for Josiah Hesse, who's an evangelical author. And so that was just nice. Should I move on to number two?
Yeah.
Yeah. So number two in my countdown was Exvangelicals Make National News, including television debut. So I talked about how our perspectives were taken into consideration. We were quoted or we wrote things for the Washington Post, Los Angeles Times. We were in Newsweek twice this year. Got a copy of that December 21st issue right here in an article about how you know, because the white evangelicals have basically become a branch of the Republican Party, they're losing the youth. And we were also featured in a CBS religion documentary called Deconstructing My Religion, which is just a really exciting moment for us.
Sure.
And then number one in my countdown, ex-evangelicals prevent evangelicals from taming the Church 2 critique. So this hashtag Church 2 that was created by Emily Joy and Hannah Posh, they've said that it was inspired both by Me Too and by Empty the Pews. They wanted to call out abuse in church and Christian contexts. And so they bravely shared their stories, and a lot of other women and men shared their stories under this hashtag. But a big part of this critique was criticism of purity culture and just this obsessive policing of sex and sexuality that you see in evangelicalism. There was a summit on December 13th at Wheaton organized by Ed Stetzer and headlined by people like Beth Moore and Max Lucado. And they initially used the Church 2 hashtag in advertising this summit, and they ignored criticism for weeks before the events from many people, including people who are Christians and pretty conservative theologically, saying that, you know, you shouldn't be discussing this issue with only these kinds of people. You know, you need real experts on abuse there. You should, if you're going to use the Church 2 hashtag, you should be in dialogue with the people who created it, and you should consider that perhaps patriarchal theology, as many of us have been saying, is a big part of the problem, and you're not going to root out abuse if you're not going to address patriarchal theology. Well, they ignored us, but luckily the media did not. And well, maybe I shouldn't say luckily, because it was also a part of, you know, a lot of work that we've been doing over the last few years to gain media visibility. And I think someone like Ed Stetzer is used to just being able to get good press by doing something like this. And this time he got, at best, you know, ambivalent press, because our perspectives were in there alongside his. And some pieces were quite sympathetic to the creators of Church 2 and the ex-evangelical community. So that's number one for me. It really demonstrates that we have changed the national conversation, and that the people who usually are able to control this conversation and spin it in the most positive way possible, people like Ed Stetzer and Russell Moore, they've lost control.
Chris, I want to take advantage of your academic specialty to talk about something that runs through all of this, the powerful confluence of patriotism and politicized religion. You've spent a lot of time studying post-secular Russia, and I'm interested in how some of what you've seen there may now be playing out in the United States.
That's a great question, Melton, and I do see a lot of parallels. I've often said that Russians and Americans have a lot in common, and perhaps that's why we make such great frenemies. You know, I think that we both exhibit what I might call a sort of imperial provincialism. Both in America and Russia, I've heard people complaining about people speaking foreign languages on the streets, for example. Once I was taking a trip to a small, beautiful town in Russia to go to a local agricultural festival, and my friends and I had bought tickets for the bus, and other people were standing room only, and we were quietly speaking English, and these Russians started talking about these foreigners taking our seats, and I thought, that's just so American, you know? I mean, yeah. it's just funny. You hear the same things, or Russians will say, well, I don't need to go on vacation in other countries. We have so much wonderful stuff here in Russia. Well, Americans, I've heard, you know, anyone who's been in the South has heard Americans say the same thing. Yeah. When it comes to post-secular Russia and this confluence of patriotism or nationalism and religion, that looks very much there with the Russian Orthodox Church, like what we see, I think, with the way that white evangelicals in particular here, and many Mormons and traditionalist Catholics have basically merged with the Republican Party. It's about tribalism. It's about power. And that is also how the Orthodox Church is mobilized there, in a very direct relationship with the state, though here, I guess, you know, we're increasingly close to that as well, because Trump has his Evangelical Advisory Council that he gives unprecedented access to. He gives exclusive interviews to CBN, and he doesn't invite more progressive religious leaders. They're shut out. So previously, of course, other presidential administrations, Democratic, Republican, when they talk to religious believers, they talk to people from all traditions. Trump really doesn't. He mostly just talks to conservative evangelicals, which is, I suppose you could say, it is kind of like the relationship between Putin and the Russian Orthodox Church. And it's been very interesting as well to watch in recent years how certain prominent conservative evangelicals have themselves warmed to Russia and Putin. And Franklin Graham has been one who will consistently repeat Kremlin propaganda talking points, which we also often hear from the Oval Office these days, which is pretty bizarre.
Yeah. Well, let's... against that backdrop, let's make the connection between these political and sociological trends and the path out of theocratic fundamentalism that you write about under the banner of ex-evangelicalism. Do you see the importance of moving away from that kind of subservience increasing?
I think that for many people, it is. I think many people are saying, you know, we're done here. Enough is too much. And again, many of those people are not abandoning Christianity, but they're going back to something, or they're discovering something that might be new to them, that for which there's a long heritage in the Anabaptist tradition, including in, you know, Baptist churches, mm-hmm. of really supporting separation between church and state, because... Right. They believe that it damages the religion. And I think that we can see quite a bit of evidence of that, you know, when you merge the two. And it's quite interesting that you can find the same criticism in Russian Christian intellectuals that I've studied from the late Russian Empire, and then many of them went into exile outside the Soviet Union. They also talked about, when they were in the Russian Empire, how this too close relationship between the church and state was damaging Christianity as they understood it.
Yeah. I want to, before we go, there's an important question I want to ask you. I want you to talk to people of faith who find themselves in a situation like the one you were in when you finally said enough. I guess I want you to preach to them and talk about what has helped to fill the void that I think many of them are afraid would take the place of all-encompassing faith based rules and regulations and the comfort of black and white thinking.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, first, I suppose I would say that it is certainly difficult and uncomfortable to make that kind of break, particularly, you know, if you've dedicated much of your life to the particular kinds of churches now that are so involved in extreme right-wing Republican politics. And, you know, you might feel very differently from the people around you in the pews of those churches. You might understand Jesus, or you might understand your Christian values in a way that differs from them. But it's scary to speak about that, because when you do, it's going to come with social consequences. But I think, you know, well, within the Christian tradition, one can understand that there might be a prophetic calling to do exactly that. And I seem to remember a certain Jewish carpenter saying something about counting the cost. And I also want to say that it is okay. It is going to be all right when you come out on the other side. There's going to be fallout. Some people lose old friends. Some people have to cut ties with family because their families won't respect their boundaries. But if what you understand Christian values to be is calling you to stand up for the rights of the marginalized in times when they're being persecuted by people in the name of Jesus, then, you know, the right thing to do is to take that moral stand. And we do have this growing community where you can connect to others. So even if you might not immediately find them offline in your life, we have a lot of resources. We have people who will be encouraging to you. And, you know, if you're doing this because you understand a different kind of Jesus than Republican Jesus, you don't have to give up your faith. You just have to sort of open yourself up to understanding it differently. For me, it was a long and protracted and painful process, and it did end with me saying, well, I can't really believe in anything metaphysical, or, you know, at least I don't think we can know anything about it. And I am going to disaffiliate from religion because it's become too triggering for me. But that doesn't happen to everybody. And so I'd say, you know, listen to that still small voice, and whether you ultimately understand it to be God or your own conscience or both, listen and follow through. That's the right thing to do.
Dr. Christopher Stroup is a freelance writer, public speaker, and commentator on religion and politics, the U.S. Christian right, Russia, and foreign policy. Currently, a senior researcher with the Post-Secular Conflicts Project at the University of Innsbruck. His Religion Dispatches column is headlined Five Key Moments from the Year of the Exvangelicals, and we'll link to it from stateofbelief.com. Chris, it's great talking with you again. I thank you for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much, Welton. I'm happy to come on anytime. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
On January 21, 2017, 5 million people, a majority of them women, took to streets around the world in an outpouring of support for the values that had brought such progress in the previous years and were seen as under attack by the result of the U.S. presidential election. The 2017 Women's March was the largest coordinated protest in U.S. history, and activated countless private citizens who had never participated in that kind of public action before. Some began a trajectory that led to victories in runs for public office less than 2 years later. Many engaged in more low-profile activism and returned to march in January 2018. Now, with the third Women's March coming up later this month, challenges have emerged that some see as inevitable growing pains, but others charge are fatal flaws in a grassroots-grounded movement. Articulate analysis of the situation appeared in the pages of the New York Times, and I am pleased to welcome the writer, Farah Stockman, to State of Belief Radio. Farah, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
It's a big story, and this is a short interview. So what are the key elements of this that it is essential for people to know?
Well, one of the things I was trying to explain in my story, and I only told part of it, is why Women's March leaders are being accused of anti-Semitism.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's probably the biggest threat right now to the movement are these accusations against the leaders of the Women's March on Washington, which have kind of been bubbling up for a year now and have kind of burst into mainstream media in recent weeks and months.
Mm-hmm. I'd like for you to begin by talking about your thoughts on this.
Well, the one thing that your listeners should understand is that the Women's March leaders on Washington made a bold choice. They decided to embrace the concept of intersectionality, which means it's not just women's rights we're talking about, but we're also talking about race and religion. And so they said, look, in the past, the mainstream feminist movement had big successes at getting wealthy white women to college-educated white women to break the glass ceilings of corporations. But it paid little attention to Black women who were working as maids, or Latina women who were facing deportation, or Muslim women who were facing Islamophobia. So they said, look, we want to actually put those marginalized voices at the forefront. And the people who used to be leading these mainstream feminist movements, we're going to ask you to be quiet and step aside so that these marginalized women can, for the first time, lead the women's movement. And so that's what they decided to do. And there were a lot of painful encounters. There were a lot of white women who felt like, hey, I don't feel invited anymore. Hey, I'm being told to sit down and shut up. And the main major question was, where do Jewish women fit into this whole picture? Because Jewish women have historically been at the forefront of progressive movements, labor movements, women's rights movements. But today they were being seen either as, hey, you guys are privileged, you ladies are privileged, and so maybe you should step aside and let others lead. Or worse, they were seen as being complicit in the occupation of Palestinian lands and overseas. So that's one part of the story, mm-hmm. is that even from the beginning, the Women's March leadership had these really tough fights about how to relate to white women and Jewish women who maybe have never thought about these other issues before. Mm-hmm.
From your perspective, is there the presence of anti-Semitism, or is the criticism that has been raised just a way of hurting the movement itself?
I don't think that the people who are raising this criticism are doing it to hurt the movement. There are some people who are just echoing it because they don't like the Women's March. They're not liberal, they're conservative, and this is a cudgel that they're using. But the women that I've talked to are Jewish women who feel as though their special history as survivors and the children and grandchildren, great-grandchildren of survivors of pogroms and the Holocaust, that the current Women's March leadership wasn't really seeing them in that way.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a tough question to answer. My editors asked me that same question, and I can see both sides. Uh-huh. On the one hand, I think that Louis Farrakhan of the Nation of Islam mm-hmm. Has helped to shape the thoughts and worldview of some of the Women's March leaders. And he has been embraced by some of the Women's March leaders as a person who speaks about black empowerment.
Mm-hmm.
And in the black community, especially in New York City, Louis Farrakhan was a celebrated figure and leader. But Jewish people see the Nation of Islam as a hate group. And Farrakhan has said terrible things about Jewish people, terrible things about women, and terrible things about homosexuals as well. So there's a lot of people who are saying, hey, why are the Women's March leaders celebrating this guy? Why are they in fellowship with him?
Mm-hmm.
And why do they have historical ties to him? So I think that's part of I think that's real. So I think Jewish people are divided. Some say, look, we should understand the good that Farrakhan has done in the black community. We should understand that he's helped rehabilitate incarcerated people, and he's done a lot of good, and we should not just throw out these Women's March leaders for associating with him.
Mm-hmm.
But others say that Farrakhan is not the kind of person who they want setting the tone for the women's movement, and they've been pretty outraged. And I should say that as attacks have been stepped up against Jewish people, we saw Charlottesville, and we saw the Tree of Life shooting. I think Jewish people have gotten more and more angry that the Women's March leaders refuse to denounce Farrakhan. They have, in fact, denounced his anti-Semitism, mm-hmm. but they haven't denounced him as a person. And so I think that's part of what's going on here. There's merit to both sides of this argument.
Yeah. So conversation that's going on right now, it's either a conversation or an argument, does that bode well for finding some common ground so that there's not the kind of conflict that we're seeing? And is this going to bleed over into other movements of revolution that's going on, or is it going to take more than we've talked about?
I think it depends on how the leadership reacts to this and behaves, because they have the potential right now to really form stronger alliances based on mutual understanding. So there's some progressive Jews who are standing by them, working with them, and saying, look, we're going to teach you more about anti-Semitism and why some of the things you've said have offended Jewish people. And, you know, in exchange, we hope that, we'll be real allies to you in the things that you're fighting for. I mean, I think the thing about the progressive movement right now mm-hmm. is that people keep saying our liberation is tied up together. So it's mm-hmm. no longer just I'm fighting for women's rights. You're fighting for the rights of black people. You're fighting for the rights of the disabled. You're fighting for the environment. There's this attempt to tie it all together, to put it all in one basket and say, we're all fighting for this group of ideas, this group of causes, which is leading to a lot of questions about what goes in that basket. Mm-hmm. And so the Women's March leadership, the ones who planned the March on Washington, they put the rights of Palestinians in that basket. And I think that that's something that a lot of young progressive Jews agree with, and it's something a lot of the older Jewish people don't agree with and may never agree with. And so you're going to have some friction that's inevitable. But if they can come through this and say we can find some consensus and deeper understanding of one another, then maybe they form an alliance that was even more powerful than they had before. Mm. But I definitely think that there's plenty of rancor. And I just also want to say that this is a very decentralized movement, and it's there are women's groups across the country that plan marches in their own cities that mm-hmm. have very little, if anything, to do with the women who plan the Women's March on Washington. Mm-hmm. And so they're sort of taking the heat for what the women who planned the Washington March have said and done, but they are not themselves actually really associated or implicated. And so the decentralization of the movement means that, a thousand flowers are blooming and people are doing things all over the country, and they're energized. And so I'm not sure that's going to go away.
So what does all of this portend then for this year's march on January 21st?
Your guess is as good as mine. I think there are people who have pulled out of the Women's March in Washington. There are some who've said they're not going to go. There's a few marches that have been canceled because of the anti-Semitism charges. I hope there's a lot of real discussion about what anti-Semitism is and how it should be differentiated from, let's say, criticism of settlements in Israel. I think that these are tough questions for the left. They're tough things for progressives to work through, but they're important questions to answer.
I guess we have to acknowledge that diversity isn't enough, important as it is. We also need new structures that are verifiably and transparently inclusive. Are you optimistic that that kind of progress ultimately is possible?
Yeah. I mean, I think you're right that diversity isn't enough to make a change, but it's a good start, right? Congress, for all these years after the Civil Rights Movement that gave black people the full rights to vote, we still had a Congress that did not represent the American public, and we're now getting closer to seeing that representation. But yeah, it's not enough. And the challenge of this generation is to look at why simply electing people doesn't automatically work. I think a lot of the young people now are questioning, how do we do things differently? How do we get a different result than they got in the 60s? Because they have expectations that are even higher than my parents' generation. They want not only the right to vote, but the right to feel comfortable on their college campuses, the right to feel just like anybody else walking down the street, which was definitely not the expectation my mother had when she was growing up as a black woman in Mississippi. So I think there's hopeful signs that the young generation are asking for more and expecting more and asking questions about how to go back and correct some of the things that were left undone by the previous civil rights movement. But this notion of intersectionality, how do we work together to form alliances across lines of difference, be them religious differences or racial differences, the reality is it's really hard. It's hard.
Yes.
And everybody has biases. You can be a black person and have biases. You can be an Asian person and have biases. And if you are elevated to a position of power, then those biases start to matter. So I do think if it were easy, people would have done it before. But I think what's being attempted now is actually quite difficult to form a truly intersectional movement that crosses all of these lines of difference. It's quite tough.
Mm. Farrah Stockman is a Pulitzer Prize-winning writer at the New York Times, which is where you'll find her insightful article titled Women's March Roiled by Accusations of Anti-Semitism. We'll link to that from stateofbelief.com. Farrah, I really thank you for taking time to be with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Now, before we go, I want to share with you my own reaction to Donald Trump's words spoken from the Oval Office this past Tuesday night, as well as note the context in which his words were spoken. In the moments prior to the beginning of the president's speech, I could hear and feel the experience of listening to John F. Kennedy tell the citizens of this nation that we could be at war with Russia by the next morning. I believed this president. People all across this nation listened to him carefully. We trusted what he said and the danger he described. As many of us gave thanks for our nation and prayed that the promise of war would be abolished. I had listened to Lyndon Baines Johnson in the Rose Garden only a few days before he announced that he would address the nation from the Oval Office. Citizens knew that something important was about to be discussed. I remember the mixed emotions that pulsated through my body as the time approached for the president to speak. Once in front of the nation, the president came to his point immediately. The president announced that he would not seek election to another term as the leader of this nation. You see, speeches from the office of the president of the United States have always occurred amid patriots' anxieties and about what was coming next for our democracy. Who could ever forget President George W. Bush beginning to speak to us in the wake of the terrorist attacks that had destroyed an iconic skyline and killed thousands of Americans on our own soil? I felt a wave of anxiety when I learned that Donald Trump would be addressing the nation from the Oval Office. Ideas of what we would hear bothered me, though I have to confess there was a small piece of hope that he would tell us that the government shutdown was over and that he was committed to working with Congress to produce a resolution of compromise and cooperation related to the challenges related to immigration. Well, 2 minutes into Mr. Trump's speech, I grew angry as well as disappointed. The president owed the nation and media outlets across the nation an apology. Donald Trump had sat where honest and respected leaders had sat before him to speak of major issues, only for him to deliver a speech with laziness, motivated by disrespect and filled with a series of untruths. Nothing was said for the good of the nation. The president had tricked the media and the American people by deciding to use the historic nature of a speech from the Oval Office only to give him time to whine about his inability to pass a piece of legislation that most of the citizens of the nation oppose, to speak with dishonesty about data related to immigration in this country, and seeking to provide his listeners with only a poorly researched policy talk that he cares about only because he wants to be able to say that he fulfilled his most talked about campaign promise. Why could he not talk about a promise that would encourage the American people to act like Americans? The kind of people who are represented by the Statue of Liberty. As the president spoke, I discovered that earlier in the day, he had told selected members of the media that the speech from the Oval Office was not worth giving and that he really didn't want to deliver it. He went on to explain that he would do the speech because three of his staff members thought it was a good idea. What? What a president! What a ludicrous comment from a man who claims to be an authority for everybody. Immediately after the speech in the Oval Office, I learned that the president's motive for the evening was more about funding his next political campaign than about helping find money to solve the crisis of inhumane treatment that is going on in the nation's southern border. Earlier in the afternoon, Donald Trump had written his base and asked them to contribute $500,000 to support his work and to send in the money before the speech was over. No sooner had the speech ended than another financial request arrived, saying that the president had noticed the specific names of the people who had not yet sent him money and he wanted them to send him money immediately. My friends, for the first time in our nation's history, a president's speech from the Oval Office was of no importance. The president had lied to the American people about a policy that should be addressed by Congress while turning the whole inappropriate event into a fundraising stunt. Sadly, it would be dishonest to say this came as much of a surprise. And of course, all of this happened with the backdrop of hundreds of thousands of government employees continuing to struggle in the face of a protected shutdown. A shutdown that, with breathtaking hypocrisy, is impacting the very border security and public safety that the manufactured border crisis purports to highlight the need for. Oh, from all of the commentaries from which I sought insights into the opinions of others about the president's speech, one stood out in my mind and impacted my behavior the most. I know my responsibility is to work for a Democratic government that fosters changes for the good of all people. But I needed to hear a comment mentioned by several people. I do not have to listen to this man. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Your generous support for this program helps keep us on the air week after week. If you've made a donation to State of Belief, this week. Let me say again, thank you on behalf of every one of our listeners. If you think there's value in what you've heard here, please make your contribution today. You can find more information at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. There you can be part of a very important and interesting conversation. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to tune in next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.